Thanks a lot. Thank you very much. Matt, thanks so much, and of course for the introduction, but especially for your outstanding leadership of the Progressive. Everyone knows how much Matt has put into this magazine and how hard you work to put out such compelling content every month. This is a proud moment for you and everyone at the Progressive, and I'm glad I could be with you to celebrate everything you've accomplished. This celebration is a wonderful moment for people who have been part of the Progressive movement throughout its history. Bob and Belle LaFollette, to William Evue and Morris Rubin. When I think of William Evue, I think of the days before there was an interstate between Madison and Janesville. We were taken to Sunday school here at Temple Beth El. There was no synagogue in Janesville. We came up here to see the great Manfred Swarzenski and to learn our Jewish learning. But my dad had that radio on all the time. And it was seemed like a million miles. And on the way home, we'd first listen to Drew Pearson give his predictions. I remember when I was 9, he said, prediction number 1, Castro will be out of office in 6 months. It's 1962. But then on would come another voice, a very shaky voice. Hello, Wisconsin, William T. Evue. And at the time, I hated it because I didn't understand why this guy was talking and we weren't home yet. But I came to know what that name and the name LaFollette meant over time. So this is a celebration of Wisconsin itself, a state at the heart of the progressive movement. This state has been a leader for progressive ideas and social justice for the last 100 years. For those of you who have come from across the country to celebrate the Progressive's anniversary, welcome to our fair state. I know you'll indulge me for a moment while I brag a little bit about Wisconsin. This is the home of the Wisconsin idea, the groundbreaking partnership between the government and university that paved the way for countless reforms, including the creation of the Social Security program and other key parts of our social safety net. This is the state that passed the nation's first effective workers' compensation program to protect people injured on the job and passed critical changes to regulate factory safety, limit working hours for women and children, and passed forest and water power conservation acts. This is the home of Fighting Bob LaFollette, who built the progressive movement in Wisconsin and became the face of the movement nationwide during his service in the Senate as one of the most successful third-party presidential candidates in the United States history as well. Now, Bob LaFollette was not always loved by his colleagues. I think he was considered a substantial pain in the neck. But in the late 1950s, when a senator was chosen to pick 5 senators to be commemorated as the greatest U.S. senators in the reception room of the United States Senate, that senator, of course, had to pick 3 from an earlier era, how could you not, Clay, Calhoun, and Webster. But they decided there would be 2 from the 20th century, one conservative and one more liberal or progressive. They picked Robert Taft of Ohio. But the picture that you see when you come into the United States Senate, where I have all the pictures taken with constituents, is the picture of that 5th senator. And that senator, chosen by the chairman of the committee, his colleagues, and by the way, the chairman's name was John F. Kennedy, that senator is Fighting Bob LaFollette, which gives me enormous pride in the progressive movement. Of course, LaFollette was also the founder of LaFollette's weekly magazine, which later became The Progressive. It was his incredible energy, his fearlessness, that helped to put progressivism on the map. And LaFollette's Weekly was a critical part of the surge in support for progressive ideas that swept the country in the early 1900s. Today is a moment to look back at this magazine's history. And, you know, this isn't some search through dusty periodicals whose ideas and whose relevance have come and gone. On the contrary, to look at this magazine over the last 100 years is to be reminded of how much passion and energy has been poured into its pages. The articles and ideas are still so relevant, so fresh and immediate, they hardly feel like history at all. They practically leap off the page with the same urgency with which they were written 50 or even 100 years ago. Some of the best are included in Matt Rothschild's wonderful compilation of articles from the magazine called Democracy in Print, the Best of the Progressive Magazine, 1909 to 2009. His book chronicles some of the many highlights from the magazine, which crackles with intellectual energy on page after page. There are so many great examples to choose from, but I'll mention just a few that strike me as particularly instructive today. Some of the most stirring passages are written by Bob La Follette himself. One was from the summer of 1919, when an angry white mob in the nation's capital went on a rampage, killing innocent African Americans in a riot that lasted for 4 days. Horrified, La Follette wrote that, quote, while the United States Senate is debating the League of Nations, which would make us custodians of peace and the instructors in democratic ideals to less enlightened peoples, we were murdering innocent, intelligent, God-fearing, law-abiding colored citizens at the back of the White House. The contrast was stark and painful, and La Follette's piece is one of many from the magazine calling for civil rights throughout the years. Belle La Follette was equally shocked by the terrible treatment of African Americans in Washington and wrote about it in the magazine herself. Her influence on the Progressive as a key contributor and editor and an important figure in the Progressive and women's rights movements was tremendous, and Wisconsinites were proud to celebrate the 150th anniversary of her birth last week. The magazine also stood firm for civil liberties even in the darkest of times. It, of course, took on, among others, Wisconsin's own Joe McCarthy. I may not have accomplished a whole lot in my career, but the one thing I've done, I've made that title, the junior senator from Wisconsin, not sound quite so bad as it did in the 1950s when it was a symbol of repression in this country. McCarthy had worked to drive the country away from the progressive ideals the magazine held dear. In the spring of 1954, then-editor Morris Rubin wrote, "The evidence is overwhelming. The McCarthyism cannot long survive where the people are given the truth about the character of his crusade." And, of course, with the recent celebration of Earth Day, the 40th consecutive Earth Day, I think it's appropriate to recognize how hard the progressive has fought to protect our environment. Earth Day's founder, Wisconsin's Gaylord Nelson, my predecessor in this job, wrote of the desperate need for Americans to wake up to this issue in 1967. 3 years before the official first Earth Day. He wrote that, quote, the natural environment of America, the woods and waters and wildlife, the clear air and the blue sky, the fertile soil and the scenic landscape is threatened with destruction. This call to defend our environment against pollution is just as powerful and relevant today as it was in 1967. And if you'll forgive me, one of the bills that I'm trying to pass is having a lot of trouble. And all the bill is a Clean Water Restoration Act that would simply return the Clean Water Act that was passed at the time of Richard Nixon to what it's been for 30 years. It's been compromised by 2-5-4 United States Supreme Court decisions. It's unjustified, but there are a lot of groups out there that would actually like to sort of turn back the clock. And they're claiming this is some big federal power grab. Well, it's not. And we need your help to make sure that this legacy of Gaylord Nelson is honored. And as I think about all the different issues that the Progressive magazine has reflected, I can't help but think about all the efforts against the Vietnam War and so many other unwise military interventions. And in that spirit, I want to simply express my sorrow at the loss of one of our greats, Midge Miller, just recently, who was such a wonderful force for progressivism in this state. You know, that's the most amazing thing about the Progressive itself. Its continued relevance long after many other magazines founded a century ago have been forgotten. It's a bridge between our past and present, how progressive thinking in America has evolved and how it has stayed true to basic principles of democracy and social justice. Now, I've recently been working on an issue that is connected both to Bob La Follette and this magazine. I've proposed a constitutional amendment to end gubernatorial appointments to the U.S. Senate and requires special elections to fill these vacancies, as is currently required for all House vacancies. I understand this isn't the number one issue facing America, But I am chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee in the Senate, and I thought we ought to fix this. Over the past several months, our country has witnessed multiple controversies surrounding appointments to vacant Senate seats by governors. The vacancies in Illinois and New York were more than just riveting political theater. They were a reminder that the citizens of these states had no say, basically, in who should represent them in the Senate. I don't make this proposal lightly. In fact, I have consistently opposed dozens of constitutional amendments during my time in the Senate, particularly those that would have altered or interfered with the Bill of Rights. The Constitution should not be treated like a rough draft. But every so often, a situation arises that so clearly exposes a flaw in our constitutional structure that it does require a constitutional remedy. My amendment would simply perfect the 17th Amendment, which was championed by Bob La Follette and called for in the pages of La Follette's Weekly a century ago. The 17th Amendment was passed to ensure the direct election of senators, replacing appointments by state legislatures. It was a great victory, but it did leave the door open for governors to make temporary appointments, as then Governor Blagojevich did in Illinois. It was scandals like the one in Illinois that created the momentum to pass the 17th Amendment in the first place. The push for the 17th Amendment began in the early 19th century and grew over the years as evidence mounted that intimidation and bribery played a role in too many Senate appointments. Senator Robert C. Byrd of West Virginia, a historian as well as a legislator, recounted one of the many examples of this appointment, a process gone awry, in a speech on the Senate floor, later published as part of his four-volume History of the United States Senate. For those of you who are troubled by the appointment process in Illinois, New York, and elsewhere, just listen to this account about efforts to select a senator in Missouri in 1905. Lest the hour of adjournment should come before an election was secured, an attempt was made to stop the clock upon the wall of the Assembly Chamber. Democrats tried to prevent its being tampered with when certain Republicans brought forward a ladder. It was seized and thrown out of a window. A fistfight followed, in which many were involved. Desks were torn from the floor, and a fusillade of books began. The glass of the clock front was broken, but the pendulum still persisted in swinging until, in the midst of a yelling mob, one member began throwing ink bottles at the clock and finally succeeded in breaking the pendulum. On a motion to adjourn arose the wildest disorder. The presiding officers of both houses mounted the speaker's desk and, by shouting and waving their arms, tried to quiet the mob. Finally, they succeeded in securing some semblance of order. Now, this was hardly what Alexander Hamilton had predicted in 1787 when he said that the state legislatures, these themselves select bodies of men, should choose senators with, quote, peculiar care and judgment. I think it's safe to call the Missouri legislative nomination process peculiar, but not in the way that Hamilton imagined. There were growing calls and publications across the country to end this system. Famously, the great William Randolph Hearst pushed the issue through a series in Cosmopolitan magazine called A Treason in the Senate in 1906. And then in 1909, along came La Follette's Weekly, which was a strong and vocal supporter of the 17th Amendment. Of course, this comes as no surprise since Bob La Follette himself was a leader of the issue. But to me, it's such a great example of how this magazine has given voice to our best values and our highest ideals since its very beginning. I asked my staff to look through the magazine back then to find references to the movement to pass the 17th Amendment. And what they found was just what you would hope and expect: full-throated support for the direct election of senators and an impatience with the senators who sought to protect the status quo and defend the system that had put them in the Senate in the first place. In February 1911, an article in La Follette's Weekly showed that frustration with those senators as the Senate blocked the 17th Amendment from passing Congress and moving to ratification in the states. The article reads, "The people of the United States demand the right to elect their United States senators by a direct vote. The Senate itself, controlled by system reactionaries, has been the one great stumbling block to this reform. For years, state legislatures have been memorializing Congress to adopt a resolution submitting to the states an appropriate amendment to the federal Constitution to accomplish the popular election of senators. All such memorials, the august American House of Lords has up to the present session answered by contemptuously ignoring them." The Follett's Weekly railed against the Senate's delay tactics. In March of 1911, the magazine described the Senate's snail-like, tedious process and mocked the supposed constitutional luminaries of the Senate for their increasingly convoluted attempts to kill the amendment. Finally, When the amendment passed the Senate and was poised to move to the states for ratification, the magazine hailed it as one of the greatest victories ever won in the struggle for popular government. Sadly, I note that the magazine's prediction that now the Senate would have to be known by another name than a rich man's club hasn't quite come to pass. But I'm doing my best to bring down the Senate's net worth every day. This historic moment when the amendment passed the Senate also led to a wonderful passage where the magazine called on its readers to take action. The duty of the progressive people of the United States is plain. There must be no let-up in their efforts to bring about the ratification of this amendment by 3/4 of the state legislatures. Begin now, citizen, to stir yourself and your neighbors to activity, an activity that will not cease until the vote on this amendment is finally taken by the legislature of your own state. No fight has ever been won until the last short shot has been fired. Let us be certain that this splendid fight for a great progressive measure is not lost at the last moment merely because, thinking it over, we have left the field to the enemy. To me, that passage is what's best about the Progressive magazine and the progressive movement. It's that powerful combination of ideas and determination, that restless pursuit of something better that has made progressivism so dynamic from the start. That passion is what helped to fuel the movement to pass the 17th Amendment and so many other issues that the progressive has fought for over the years. That same passion still courses through the veins of this magazine to this day, and that is what still makes it so relevant and so important a century after its founding. Again, thank you for having me here today. It's a joy to celebrate this anniversary and this magazine's many contributions to Wisconsin and the nation with all of you. Thank you very much.
Today or not?